you know, ahead on this. They decided that they were going to have to sustain this research enterprise themselves until, you know, some other arrangement came along.
Yeah.
And so they did.
Well, as I say, that played a very, very important role. I never had ONR money. And I had the impression that most of that went into the physical side of chemistry. Colleagues of mine had ONR money. Yeah, but I think that was not a usual kind of thing. And I don't think I ever even applied for ONR money. But these other things were just out there, you know, like ripe apples sitting on a tree, and if you needed money, you could get it from the FOSR or what have you.
And you didn't have to claim any particular application. Or if you could send the same grant application to NSF and the
OSR. Oh, maybe, maybe one or two sentences of was sort of a fig leaf or a concession to their mission orientation, and to indicate solidarity. Let's put it that way. That, of course, was one of the things that turned me off. That I really couldn't any longer continue to do that. So yeah. So that's all I have to say about that. I think they did a fine thing, and I don't know where that stands at the moment. I have the impression that there's less and less of it now, maybe not much at all. So, but that's, yeah, and I think this is true for all the agencies, and that's a subject we could spend a lot of time talking about if you want to, about what's happened to funding, other aspects of funding.
Dealt with the resolution instead of chemical correlation of the warning and the acid.
Yeah.
I guess the important part there was the use of the isotopic organite.
Yeah.
Just to say a word about that, but that was very clever, and I wondered whether Terminate people picked that up afterwards. We were doing the isotope dilution as an agent of termination of
I think that may have been in the title of the paper.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
But it was sort of as a side point. We were doing this project, and here we did this.
That's
right.
Well, isotopic dilution, of course, was a known technique, and in fact, as we cited in the paper, the use of isotopic dilution to determine enantiomeric purity had been used. We were not the originators of that. That was originated by Graf, Rittenberg, and Foster, the three biochemists at Columbia P&S. And there had been a claim in the literature that in certain forms of tumors, malignant tumors, that these growths contained cells that were very rich in D amino acids. So the question became, how do you determine whether there are D amino acids in these tumors? And the point was, if you analyze using paper chromatography or some chromatographic technique like that, that doesn't distinguish D from L. So there's a long, tedious process that would have to be used in order to determine for each amino acid what the enantiomeric purity was and whether, in fact, the D form was dominant. So Rittenberg, who had been a student of he had worked with Urey, I guess, at Columbia, and then he had gone to P&S to work with Schoenheimer. He had set up all Schoenheimer's isotopic analysis lab, which at that time was based upon deuterium mostly. And Rittenberg and these other two fellows, Graf and Foster, worked out a method for direct analysis for the amino acid they were interested in was glutamic acid. And they did this by isotopic dilution. But they never took it any further. They certainly never applied it to any organic system. It was buried in the biochemical literature. Now, what happened was that at the time that we had to do this, I thought of this way of doing it. And in retrospect, I have to admit, and I did come to the realization before we published that paper, but it wasn't in my mind consciously at the time that I thought of this idea, that, well, why can't we do this by isotopic dilution? Because we had been doing some other experiments in which we'd use isotopes. And so I sat down and I wrote out all the equations for doing this that allowed us to do that analysis by this means of isotopic dilution. And we were writing this paper up, and then I said, wait a minute, I've seen this before. And it turns out that this paper was published in about 59, I guess it was. Probably 15 years before that, I had given a seminar when I was an undergraduate on that paper of Rittenberg. And so it all came back to me. I reinvented the wheel. I didn't realize it until we were ready to publish the paper. And it fortunately came into my head, because if we had published it as an original thing, we would have made a much bigger story out of it, and then it would have been very embarrassing for somebody to say, hey, look, this was done a hell of a long time ago. So it worked out very well. But I think the importance of this was not so much the use of isotopes, if I may say so. The importance was that this is the first time that I'm aware of that anybody used a method for direct analysis of enantiomers other than optical rotation. And then that was followed, of course, by other methods which are much more convenient, using NMR. And so this thing fell pretty much into limbo, since nobody was going to take the trouble to do an isotopic dilution if you could do it with a simple NMR experiment using a chiral shift reagent or something like that. Put through a chiral column. It's trivial now. But this was the first, really. So I really, that was an important paper, I think.
I guess it's already clear from how you describe USC why you went to Wisconsin, but can you tell us what was going on? The year before you left Wisconsin, you were actually at UCLA.
Before I left USC.
Before you left USC.
Yeah,
UCLA, and I wondered if you were being considered for a position there.
I didn't spend a whole year there. I spent part-time. I was teaching a course. Saul wanted me to come and teach a course, and I would go over, I think, 3 mornings a week or something like that. But I didn't spend much time there. I don't think I even had an office there. I just came and gave the lectures, and if students wanted to talk, we would go to their lab or something like that. So I wasn't really at UCLA. I just traveled across town on the freeway, you know, the usual thing. But well, if you asked me about whether UCLA was considering me at that time, they never asked me directly. If they had, I would have jumped, no question. But they didn't, and I subsequently learned that they had, they had talked about it, but they decided that it was carrying coals to Newcastle. By then I was too strongly in that area. They already had that covered very thoroughly. So he came out of Woodward's lab, you know, and he was doing I don't know what, but very different things from what he ended up doing. So his history was sort of parallel to mine, actually.
But you didn't go across town, but you
went to one of the coldest, right. So Wisconsin was really a glorious opportunity for me, and it was six of the happiest years of my life, because for the first time I really felt that the impediments had been removed from me. The resources were available, not only in terms of students, but also in terms of excellent new lab space and very active colleagues at department, a going, thriving department with a great tradition in all fields of chemistry, and some very active people whom I learned a lot from and interacted with very strongly. So it was just a different world. I got into the major leagues, is basically where it, I mean, I don't want to say anything derogatory about USC, but that was a backwater as far as chemical research was concerned. There was very little going on there.
Did they come and recruit you?
Yeah, I got a phone call from Harlan Gehring, and his usual way, he said, "Hey, what are you doing?" So we moved then in 63, in the summer of 63, and almost immediately I began to attract a large number of students, many of them outstanding students, and
going down the country, there's a bursting school of
well, a lot of students went in their own work. I mean, if you say a school, they were my students, but by gosh, they a lot of them didn't work on problems that they were working on with me. They went off in all directions, and at first I guess I felt a little bit, hey, what are you guys doing? But I learned to love it. I think it was great. So they went out and we did a lot of interesting things, and it was a very lively group. We had a certain amount of fruitful. It was a fruitful time, and we discovered some things that I thought were interesting, and probably at least we thought they were important, there is a kind of an autocatalytic effect, and that is that if you have a certain amount of momentum going, the students are being accreted to this pile, their energy and their determination and their intellect just drives, it adds to the ferment of the whole thing. And so I was floating on a running stream of bubbling ideas and accomplishments that these people were turning out. They were pushing me all the time. I had to work like a beast to keep up with them. And you know, we kept changing, but the problems we were working on kept evolving and shifting completely, dramatically into new areas. So that was all. That was a very seminal time in my career. Yeah. Thermal rearrangements. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, in this particular case, you found the final suggestion was that it was a stepwise
The mechanism for the what we were trying to show was that there really were two pathways, one of which starts out with the two ene groups syn to each other. You may remember that there were two stereoisomers of the starting material, and the vinyl group in one instance was pendant over the double bond that it had to become attached to make the Copley arrangement occur, and in the other case it was pointed away. So to us at that time, since the Copley arrangement, we agreed the Copley arrangement was that the ordinary Copley arrangement was a conserved reaction. But what we found was that even when the vinyl group was pointed away, and therefore there was no hope of it being a conserved, that one also gave the Copley product. So that was the origin of that title of that paper, that we had found a non-conserved Copley arrangement. Now the other significance of that, of course, is that it became a synthetically very important kind of transformation. And we pointed out that in the paper, that in one of those papers anyway, that you could make unsaturated cyclohexanones that way by the Copley arrangement. And of course it became very popular when Evans found that you could accelerate this thing many orders of magnitude by using the anionic version of it, by putting in a potassium hydride or something like that, and that became much faster, so you didn't have to heat it up, and it made it compatible with all kinds of tender functional groups on big molecules that people were trying to synthesize. So there are many, many references to the Copley arrangement, the oxy-Copley arrangement in organic synthesis. Very few of them to our paper, by the way. Well, we haven't complained about that. In fact, I met a fellow in Taiwan, his name I won't mention, a very kind and nice fellow. He told me that he was very disappointed. He always admired the oxy-Copley arrangement, and it had turned out to be such an important component of an organic synthesis, and that he was a synthetic organic chemist, and he was very upset that most people don't recognize that it was really developed in our lab. And this fellow then somewhat later in the day made me a present of a book that he had written on called The Tactics of Organic Synthesis or something like that. So in leaping through there, I looked up the oxy-Copley arrangement, and sure enough, he discusses it at great length. He doesn't mention it. Well, yeah. Well, that and the work that we did, also at Wisconsin, George Nelson's work on the, which was the culmination of a series of papers on the thermal 1,3 sigmatropic rearrangement, rearrangements of. The one that he worked on was in the 320, bicycle 320 heptene rearrangement. But we were working on other thermal rearrangements, somewhat after that. We started working on stereomutation of cyclopropanes in about 68, but the Nelson paper came out in 67. But that followed what we were trying to do there. Depends how far back you want to go. We this really goes back to an early interest in the Diels-Alder reaction. And we had written a paper, Sid Benson and I had written a couple of papers on the use of pressure effects on liquid phase reactions. And one of the key examples of that was some work that Chevis Walling did on the Diels-Alder reaction, on the dimerization of, I don't remember what it was, the cyclobutadiene, cyclopentadiene dimerization. And he had come to the conclusion that for measuring, I use the word measuring in quotation marks, measuring the volume of activation, which you could get from the pressure dependence of the rate constant. At least that was what was thought at the time. He came to the conclusion that this was a stepwise reaction because the transition state was very large, was much larger than the product, so that you went to a, in his view, a very loose kind of transition state, and that to him meant you were making only one bond, so it was occupying much more volume, and it was going through a diradical intermediate, rather than a tight transition state which you'd have from a concerted reaction. So Sid and I wrote two papers, we were both criticizing this work of Walling's, and our papers were subsequently criticized by other people. Benson was at USC, so this was in the USC days. Yeah. That's absolutely, absolutely. Oh, sure. This work was done in the early 60s. Yeah. So, anyway, so I became very interested then because he was a thermal reaction. I was getting very interested in thermal reactions, and there was clearly a whole category of thermal reactions that could be formulated with biradical intermediates or as concerted reactions. And this became one of the big problems of the next couple of decades in physical organic chemistry. How do you tell the difference between these two? So that we segued from there into really studying biradicals directly, not as necessarily as components, not as points on transition state or transition states or intermediates, but as actual observable species. And so that's how we got into that area. But all through that period, from starting at USC and going to Wisconsin and continuing here, you were working on thermal rearrangements and the idea of investigating the role of biradicals in those reactions was a center of our attention during that whole period. And that was during that time that you saw a couple of papers in which you said that I was saying something negative about Bill Dering or something that Bill had said. Actually, I never mentioned him. I mentioned what he had said, and I was arguing against it. But I'm not sure which paper you're thinking of, but I don't think I quoted. Or I may have been in the cyclopropane paper. Yeah, I did.
I had actually typed out that he concluded that these distributions were excellent, doing the 35-55 ratio, and that many pointed out. His results were, in fact, directly opposite from the ratio that had been predicted. And since the predicted order of preference is the reverse of that reported experimentally, the nature of the alleged agreement is not clear.
Yeah, that's well, you know, I had.
He was still here.
No, he was at Harvard. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. So he, first of all, he never believed that work that we published, and I couldn't get him to discuss it, really. I tried. I sent him preprint copies of the paper, you know, in manuscript form. I said, well, you know, we'd really like to talk to you about this, but I never could generate a discussion with him. He just brushed it aside, and The other thing that... Well, you know, it's a very interesting point you raise, because 17 years later, John Baldwin submitted a paper to Jax in which he claimed to have found an error in that kinetic analysis. So it's, somebody did review it. Unfortunately, his correction was wrong. So his paper never got published. I think that everybody was, I think, should be pleased that it worked out that way, because I didn't want to get into a public shouting match. But he had found something in the Beagle Eisen equation about isotope effects, and we had to make some corrections for isotope effects there, and he thought that that invalidated the whole derivation. It was a factor of two that we had gotten wrong. Well, it could easily have been the case, because there are lots of factors of two there. If you're not very careful, it's easy to make a mistake. But as luck would have it, we hadn't made a mistake, and he had made a mistake, so... But I had another criticism there of Goering, and that was that he had done something that was, this thing was quite confusing that he had there, because it was that you just quoted, because that was simply contradictory to what had been predicted. But another thing that he had done in there, which was just flat out incorrect, was he had combined two rate constants and calculated an activation energy from the sum of two rate constants. Now, in transition state theory, you're not supposed to do that, because there is one rate constant per transition state. You can't have, it's a no-no. It's like having a bifurcation at the transition state. Now, you may have it if transition state theory doesn't apply, but he was calculating an activation energy. That means transition state theory. So that was simply an error. And we pointed out that his ratios for internal rotation versus ring closure were off, because he had calculated these activation energies by that erroneous process. So there really were two criticisms here. Yeah, that's one place where we disagreed, where I mentioned them by name, but there are other places where I haven't mentioned them by name, but I put down arguments that he was putting forward at that time where we disagreed. But I think that's Well, let's hope that wasn't true. I try to keep it on a scientific basis.
You probably looked at the Tokyo many times, but there was a 1990 paper that you referred to that was used by Little Tokyo.
Yeah.
In that particular case, you're actually looking for biradical things.
Exactly.
I wondered why, what that was for.
Okay.